From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Former Vice President Joe Biden has maintained his front-runner status among Democrats for his party's presidential nomination. But given Biden's very long political career, there is much to explore in his record and compare to what he says now. One of the most glaring instances of revisionism that Biden has engaged in is his vote for the 2002 Iraq War. Biden claimed that he quickly backtracked on supporting the war, but analysts have pointed out just how untrue this claim is. Meanwhile, a new film based on a true story of a British whistleblower called Official Secrets has revived those fraught months when the West concocted a deceptive case for the Iraq War nearly two decades ago. My guest is Norman Solomon, a journalist with ExposeFacts.org, a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy, where he's the executive director. Norman is also the author of a number of books, one of which is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He's also co-founder of RootsAction.org. Welcome to the program, Norman.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
So first, let's go through exactly who Biden was during that time in 2002 when the vote took place and what exactly he voted for. He wasn't just a quiet supporter. He said words. He expressed himself very clearly about how he felt on the situation in Iraq and then Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, right?
Yes, Joe Biden was perhaps the most powerful senator to bring about the war resolution that was passed in mid-October of 2002. And of course, early the next year in March, the invasion began for a war in and on Iraq that is still continuing today. He was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and chaired very important hearings in the middle of the summer of 2002, where he excluded any critical voices. All the disagreement from the witnesses he allowed was over tactics, over how to attack Iraq, not whether to do so. And I think it's fair to say that more than any other senator out of 100, more than any other, he was responsible for shepherding through that war resolution.
Even he more so extremely than Republicans?
Yes, because he chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and that's the panel that was charged with hearings and passing the legislation on to the full Senate.
So he made very clear that he felt Saddam Hussein had to go, but at some point he did turn against the Iraq war, right? When did that happen?
Well, he sort of kind of turned against the Iraq war, sort of. He was cheering it on well over a year after the invasion. He said his vote was the correct vote. And it was not until 2.5 years after the invasion of Iraq that he, for the first time, this was on NBC's Meet the Press, for the first time, he acknowledged that his vote was wrong. He called it a mistake. But in literally the next breath, he blamed President George W. Bush for his bad vote. He said, yes, the vote was a mistake. I trusted President Bush. And I shouldn't have done that. And part of the sort of scrambled explanation he's given during the campaign for president now in recent weeks is that he claims he just was voting for the war resolution to give more leverage for the United Nations to get weapons inspectors back into Iraq for what turned out to be non-existent weapons of mass destruction. The problem with that explanation is it's bass-ackwards. The timeline is inverted. And in fact, 25 days before Biden voted in favor of that war resolution, the Iraqi government had already announced it was letting the weapons inspectors back in. So overall, Sonali, I think we could say that Biden is grasping at straws, doing as much damage control as he can, mindful that Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq war was very damaging to her when she was unsuccessfully running against Barack Obama in 2008 for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Now, Biden has run for the Democratic nomination in the past. Has he said those same, or has he revised history in what it was about 10 years ago, you know, because he also ran for the nomination when Hillary ran but pulled out earlier. Did he repeat those lies, or it just was that he wasn't questioned enough about the Iraq war vote before?
Yeah, well, his latest run was so brief and unsuccessful that it didn't really come to a head in terms of public discourse. But if you go back to, 1988, of course, that was his scandal-plagued first run for president, when it turned out he had plagiarized some of his speeches. And that was actually well before the Iraq war.
Now, Biden has also come under fire for making, you know, for telling stories with details that are made up out of whole cloth. He seems to play fast and loose with reality and with the truth in a way that is quite extreme compared to other candidates, and really seems to compare well to Trump. I mean, do you feel that he is someone that can be trusted with the truth, not just on this Iraq issue, but in general?
Well, I would say in terms of the Democratic presidential candidates, he is the leading front runner confabulator. He twists and turns around information and seems to fantasize certain elements of narratives that he puts forward. Of course, nobody can come close to Trump, who's, you know, just a pathological liar. But that's, I mean, talk about a high jump over abysmal standards. That's the sort of the political terrain we're in. I think it should be said that the corporate mass media, and certainly the corporate Democratic Party power structure, they've put their money literally and figuratively on Joe Biden. And increasingly, there's no fallback. So the power structure of the party is committed to Biden and vice versa. And that is manifested, among other things, in just extreme efforts to cover up or at least minimize the damage that Biden is doing to his own reputation in terms of having a grip on the facts. So it's hard to know internally whether Joe Biden believes some of the stuff he's making up about his Iraq war record in terms of his political position on it. Does he really believe it or not? I mean, that's more a realm of psychoanalysis than political analysis. But we can say that when Biden, as he did in late July of this year at one of the presidential debates, claims that he opposed the Iraq war from, as he said, the first moment of shock and awe, the first moment of the war, I mean, that's just preposterous. He claimed that he opposed the war as soon as it began, as much as anyone in the House or Senate. That is just an absurdity. And while certainly the incontrovertible haziness and sometimes dishonesty that has become so clear from Biden has compelled a lot of the corporate media to point it out and to raise questions about his fitness for office, overall, I think you could say the mass media of this country have been fairly gentle with Biden. And that politically, I believe, is largely because there is no fallback. Kamala Harris, another corporate militarist candidate, is sinking in the polls. Nobody else is coming up to carry the corporate potential presidential mantle. And so that leaves, if it isn't Joe Biden, it would seem to be either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and corporate media and corporate power brokers certainly don't want either one of them.
So given the way in which the Iraq war played out and the, you know, looking back on it, the very clear manufacturing of evidence to form the basis for an illegal war, it should be a pretty obvious mark against any candidate running for office today if they supported that war and didn't apologize for it. So Biden has not apologized. He simply claimed that he, you know, very, very soon after that war, changed his mind about it. And I think he's relying on the fact that the responsibility for that entire war falls on the Bush administration, George W. Bush in particular, and, you know, the people in his administration, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. But you were there, right, in Iraq ahead of the war, Norman, and you write about that. And I remember that time as well when all of us were watching aghast, seeing politicians make up lies about weapons of mass destruction out of whole cloth. And there were many, many opportunities for politicians like Joe Biden to see the light, to see that this was just Bush's lies, and to do something to stop it. But he was an active participant. Take us back to that time and what you witnessed in Iraq and how that whole debacle played out, a story which is now being told on the big screen in this new movie.
Yes, really, Joe Biden was a principal character on Capitol Hill in the real-life drama of manufacturing the pretext for an invasion of Iraq. And as I mentioned, as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was just crucial in being the sort of traffic cop on who could speak for the invasion and making sure no one would speak against it. My first trip to Baghdad as executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy was a delegation that we sponsored, led by then Congressman Nick Rahal from West Virginia and also the great former U.S. Senator Jim Abares. And we went in the middle of September 2002. It was an avowedly pro-peace intervention. We met with Tariq Aziz, the number two in the Iraqi government. And as it happened, really within a day or so after our meeting with Tariq Aziz, the Iraqi government, whether by coincidence or not, reversed its position and announced with a letter hand-delivered to Kofi Annan, the Secretary General at the United Nations, that Iraq would let the weapons inspectors back into Iraq and have free run of the country with no restrictions whatsoever. And this was a huge change. The White House didn't like this because they were ginning up for war with the argument that, oh, they're not letting a thorough inspection take place. Well, this figures into what we're talking about in terms of Joe Biden, because one of the straws that he's been grasping at in recent weeks to try to justify what is unjustifiable, his support for the Iraq war and his vote for that war resolution, is he claims that, oh, I was just voting for this because we wanted to give leverage to the U.S. government to get the UN to be able to send the weapons inspectors back into Iraq. So for me, as somebody who was in Baghdad at the time that this big change in Iraqi policy was announced, which was a wonderful breakthrough and potentially could have forestalled, prevented the war, to now hear Joe Biden just making up, you know, it's sort of like in U.S. history saying, well, you know, there was the War of 1812 to prevent or an attempt to prevent the American Revolution of 1776. It's just backwards. And the question remains to what extent the U.S. mass media will call him on what is just another wrinkle in a long, very long fabric of attempted deception on his part in terms of his record and the Iraq war.
So let's talk about the new film, Official Secrets, which is just out in theaters here in the United States. It's a British effort. It's a British story. And it's about a British whistleblower. And you say that that movie, this, you know, essentially a work of art based on a true story, actually is more truthful about how the Iraq war began than Joe Biden. Tell us about Catherine Gunn, this whistleblower at the heart of this film, and who, through her very brave actions, almost managed to stop the war.
Yes, unusually, this narrative feature now being shown in multiplexes around the United States is very true to history. It's very accurate. It's scrupulous in its script in portraying how then in her late 20s, Catherine Gunn, a translator at the British equivalent to the NSA, the GCHQ, came across a memo from the U.S. National Security Agency on her computer screen, showing that the U.S. and British governments were engaging in intensive illegal surveillance of all members of the U.N. Security Council, particularly those who might vote either way in terms of approving a war resolution, which President Bush and especially British Prime Minister Tony Blair desperately wanted for political cover. And I think it's stunning at a human as well as political level that an estimated 100 people at the GCHQ saw that memo at the end of January 2003. Only Catherine Gunn was upset about it enough, saw the implications of the skullduggery, the deception that it was engaged in as an operation to try to push through a pro-war resolution at the UN. Only she was willing to serve as a whistleblower. And so a few weeks later, the British newspaper, The Observer, which by the way was a pro-war newspaper, did the journalism to expose this memo. So Catherine Gunn faced a couple of years in prison. She went through that ordeal for about a year. Tony Blair's government finally dropped the charges because they didn't want, in effect, to have to submit to legal discovery and have the war put on trial, their mendacity about the war put on trial. And, you know, from our vantage point at the Institute for Public Accuracy, we worked very hard from the very day that that article was published in The Observer to get the U.S. media to cover it. And they did almost no coverage, the mass media. The New York Times, I talked to one of their top editors a couple of days later. They refused to cover it. They said, we do our own reporting. And then when the CIA and the NSA refused to verify that it was an authentic memo, you had like the Los Angeles Times doing a small story saying, well, some experts say it's not even authentic. Well, of course it was authentic. Catherine was arrested. She was put on trial for leaking that memo. And we've had a failure of U.S. news media for a decade and a half in covering this basic story, which showed how low the Bush administration sank to try to manipulate the United Nations to get behind this illegal, immoral, slaughtering war. And in this year, finally, this information is coming out to the U.S. public. So I think, Sonali, one way to sum it up is that after a decade and a half of failure by the U.S. corporate media, the entertainment industry has finally stepped up and informed the public of the United States about these crucial historic events for the first time.
So let's actually watch the trailer of the film Official Secrets. Keira Knightley plays Catherine Gunn.
What we know is that Saddam has this material.
We don't know that. I mean, he just keeps repeating the lie.
Just because you're the Prime Minister, it doesn't mean you get to make up your own facts.
Someone in this building has betrayed their country. If you are found to have withheld information, you will be charged with a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
Catherine Gunn. Who do you think might have leaked the Gozer email?
I've got something you need to see.
Who brought you this?
Friend?
Be careful.
If this is real, you could go to jail just for having it in your possession.
You're a spy. You work for the British government.
No, I work for the British people. I do not collect information so that the government can lie to the British people.
Intelligence may be being manipulated to take this country to war.
This paper needs to stop taking Tony Blair at face value.
You had nothing to gain and everything to lose.
This could result in a prison sentence.
Do you want to risk it all?
This war is historically unpopular.
It's everywhere, every country. Biggest demonstration in human history.
If we do not go public,
We would be conceding that no one can ever tell the people when their government is lying.
And that is the trailer of the film Official Secrets, where Keira Knightley plays the role of Catherine Gunn, the British whistleblower. Norman, as I was watching this trailer, I was wishing that this was an American-made film, right? Because the US played a much bigger role in the Iraq War than the UK did. But still, at least, you know, with someone like an actor with the name recognition of Keira Knightley, it might get some good viewership here in the U.S.
Yes, well, it's getting a very strong audience response from the surveys I've seen online, including at sites like Rotten Tomatoes, and a pretty good overall response from the critics. There's a sort of bittersweet irony in the fact that media outlets that refused to cover what Catherine Gunn exposed when it really could have made a difference in real time. Now, many of them, better late than never, I suppose, are praising the film. One example is that the film reviewer, the main film reviewer at the Los Angeles Times, wrote a review of this film and near the top said that this is an unknown story for most Americans because it was primarily a British story, that Catherine Gunn was British and so forth. Well, that's ridiculous and ironic because it was newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, in the United States that covered up this story in the first place. When the story was leaked, when it was in the Observer, when it had headlines created in countries around the world like Mexico and Chile, where their delegations were being wiretapped and they were outraged in those countries, the media were for the most part, because this came to light and because it was so clearly illegal and against diplomatic principles. And so here's, you've got the LA Times in 2019 telling its readers that they didn't know about it because it was a British story, when the LA Times actually told their readers that it was probably a fake memo to begin with. And most other US media outlets didn't cover it at all at the time, when it could have made a huge difference for people to learn about it.
The US media has in years following the Iraq War taken some responsibility for not accurately enough, or for not holding more of a light to the claims by the Bush administration that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. But it seems as though they've never acknowledged their total ignoring of the story of Catherine Gunn in Britain. So it's a sort of a very limited mea culpa, huh?
Yes, very much. And in terms of coverage of the film, it's virtually unacknowledged. As you say, there's been some self-restrained, self-flagellation, you might say, about failures to cover the lead up to the Iraq War with journalistic standards of any sort that one might be proud of, just swallowing the weapons of mass destruction line that was coming from the U.S. government. I think there's been a slight improvement, but not much, when it comes to, say, the war drums that beat incessantly to attack Iran. And even though we would hope that the U.S. mass media would learn from the horrific bloodshed resulting from prior journalistic failures, there's still a very strong tendency to assume that what the U.S. government says about Iran is true. And based on, I think, independent journalism, for the most part, that is a ridiculous assumption. So it falls to independent journalists and media outlets such as the one that people are watching and listening right now to, we've got to pick up the slack. We've got to challenge the mass media, the corporate media, and we've got to further build our own independent media outlets. Mm-hmm.
Norman, we're on the verge, it seems, of yet another war in that region of the world, with the U.S. Sort of tiptoeing the line of whether or not to launch a retaliatory strike on Iran for what it says was the strike on Saudi Arabia. I'm wondering if, given the public just distaste for what happened in the Iraq war, that the U.S. media and, of course, most importantly, the establishment, a political establishment, is hesitant to start a new war, notwithstanding folks like John Bolton, because of the disaster that the Iraq war turned into.
Clearly, there is some hesitancy there. And contrary to the time of the Vietnam War, where the Joint Chiefs of Staff were pushing the White House to keep escalating in Vietnam, it's really different. The Pentagon is much more concerned about and back channel or behind the scenes warning against an attack on Iran. But still, the military-industrial intelligence complex is reaping huge profits from the use of these weapons, the sales of these weapons to countries such as Saudi Arabia. So we have this tremendous repetition compulsion disorder hazard that the inclination to engage in military attacks would be again unleashed. And you know, one of the many outrageous and sad, almost Orwellian or Orwellian ironies is that when you look at countries that have engaged in invasions in the Middle East, top of the list is the United States. Israel is high up on the list. Saudi Arabia, as now it's causing such carnage in Yemen, it's on the list. You can't find in the last century an example of Iran invading another country, and yet we're told that they're the threat to the region.
Well, Norman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the article that you wrote about Biden's Iraq War Lies and the movie Official Secrets from our website. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
Norman Solomon is a journalist with ExposeFacts.org, a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy, where he's the executive director. He's also the author of a number of books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and co-founder of RootsAction.org. We've been discussing Biden's Iraq war lies. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.